You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Today I'm talking to the brilliant Jess Fostercue. And forgive me if my voice is slightly lower than usual. I have a sleeping baby on my tummy in one of those carrier type things. So I am talking, but you might hear me be in a slightly lower register than usual. And also you might hear some snuffly breathing. Can you hear that? There she is. That's the girl. Very asleep. So before we go into this conversation, thank you to the Angel Comedy Club, angelcomedy.co.uk, who allowed us to record this in their fabulous venue, the Bill Murray, which remains a really interesting experiment in a bunch of comedians and comedy-related people getting together, getting a lease on a building and actually putting their hearts and souls into making it work as an everyday comedy club with a load of additional space. It's a hub of courses and networking. No, networking is completely the wrong word, but you could learn loads of stuff there about comedy, and they're just really good people and people who are very passionate about the art, as I know you are. So angelcomedy.co.uk, I've got to admit I'm guessing that web address, but I feel like I've written it down on email addresses before, so I think that's the one. Loads of great stuff going on there, and I saw Rory Scovel there recently and Eddie Izzard. More on those in the middle bit. But for now, this is Jess Fostercue. She is a fabulous act. She's incredibly accessible and watchable, and she's been those things for years. She's always been very funny, and now she is extremely funny. So it's been great. One of those acts that's been really brilliant watching develop over the last few years into someone that is a real powerhouse now. We talk about this at the beginning of the interview. We'll start talking about The Silence of the Nans, which is her story show. It's not really a story show, it's a stand-up show, but it's a story structure about a disastrous gig she did on a cruise, and it's so listenable. I believe it's on Next Up. If you go to nextup.com, you can watch it live there. I just had the audio from that gig. And it's a belter of a gig and such an accessible comic. And I don't mean accessible in a negative way at all. I suppose it has certain connotations of just, you know, well, why are you pointing out the accessibility? Surely you should be talking about how funny she is. She's very funny, but by accessible I mean she's one of those comics who you could watch as like a fifth show at Edinburgh if you were really sinking your teeth into the festival. You've seen four or five shows and you're like, oh, I'm a bit done. No, you can definitely squeeze in a Jess Fostercue show, because she is just as well as being very, very funny, big punchy stuff, fantastic characterisation, she's also just someone you can just plug into. She's a plug-and-play comedian, so whatever that means, she's one of them. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, this is Jessica Fostercue. Where do I want to start? It's an interesting one. Sometimes I've got an angle of attack. With you, I feel like my most fresh kind of angle, having listened to your show last night, in fact, The Silence of the Nans, yeah, which is on Next Up.
It is, yeah, yeah.
What number show of yours is that?
God, I need to know that, don't I? I'm going to have to count them live on my fingers like a child. 2011 was my first hour. 2012 I did one. 2013 I did one. 2014 was a work in progress and a play, so no, that doesn't count, does it? 2015, I did one. 2017, I did one. Did I do one in 2016? Oh, God. That's awful that I can't remember.
Think of how you felt in 2016 and how important to you it was or wasn't, if that ever happened.
Or wasn't. I don't think I did. I just had my kid. I didn't go at all.
Of course. Got a bit of a blank on that year. Yeah. Oh, yes, I had a child.
I was doing something else. Just one other thing. That means sixth show.
I was really struck, having not seen, I don't think, any of your other shows. I've seen you at gigs.
Fifth. God, I can't even count to five.
I feel like I've seen you at gigs here and there. The two that stick in my mind were one at the Museum of Comedy.
I knew you
did your Magneto bit. And I remember thinking, fucking hell, Jess has got really good. Like,
that's so funny because you were so kind about that bit that night and I never, ever made it fly.
No, really?
Yeah. I mean, I still put it in a show, which is telling. That was 2013.
Okay.
And that was in a bit of the show, which after that year I went, never, ever do a show again where there's bits in it you know still don't work. Just have a shorter show.
This is a classic bit of Goldsmith advice. I tried a bit once. I said, oh, it's great. I love that bit.
But and lots, it went of comedians on to ruin the thing for you. Lots of comedians did. I had lots of comedians. Not lots is pushing it. Then I sound like a big head. But I had a variety of comedians say, oh, and I think it was just a nice analogy, but the whole bit itself, flabby.
Ah, fair. Great analogy, though. But that was, for me, that was the moment where I kind of went, ooh, I did a bit of a spit take. I was like, ooh, God. Because I'd seen you at gigs here and there. We had another one in some godforsaken market town, can't even remember. Mm. It was one of those ones that nearly got pulled. And we all turned up and went, there's only six people. I hope this gets pulled. And then four more people turned up. We went, oh, Christ. And it was fine. But we were, you know, it was not test conditions.
No.
And I think everyone did fine.
Yeah.
But that, the Museum of Comedy one, I really sort of noticed, I had that thing of having known you and seen you at gigs here and there for a bit, I sort of had a sensation that you'd gone up a gear.
Oh,
do thanks. You, and I've certainly experienced those things myself, I've gone, ooh, I've got a bit better. Yeah. Does that mean, is that meaningful to you? Do you feel that you kind of improve in stages?
Definitely, yeah. God, it's so hard to perceive it in yourself. I hope I do. I find it much easier to see that with other people. I worked with someone this weekend who I haven't worked with for probably 2 or 3 years and was like, oh, what a great MC now. Not that I ever thought they were a bad one, but you know when you're like, what? Yeah, you've got a really, really special set of skills now, and that's really amazing.
And you don't want to name them. You don't want to name them because it will accidentally.
It would sound like you were being rude about them historically.
Yeah, sure,
it was Diane Spencer. I just hadn't worked with her for years.
Oh, God, yeah.
And she's resident MC in a club now. Okay. And so you get something, I think you get something special when you're resident somewhere. You get this little, you know, it's your turf. It's like a gig at home in a way, even though, you know, it's a big gig. She was really brilliant, really brilliant. And the only reason you'd shy away from saying that is if you sounded like you were surprised. I've never thought, you know, but you just don't. You know, I'm not someone who goes around going, I'm genuinely not someone who goes around thinking, I think they're shit. I grew out of that kind of toxicity because it is toxic really early in my career. I'm so grateful that I did. But you know, you just, if you're not working with someone, you're not necessarily thinking about them. And it's so lovely when you gig with someone after years and you go, oh, yeah, they're really, there's a real fire in the tummy. You can feel it.
And do you notice those things in yourself? You say that's harder to spot.
No, I don't. I get them in, I get, every now and again, I get a nice, I don't get it in chunks. I don't get it in every couple of year chunks. I had a big... I think probably about 7 years in, I realised that the annual, while you're preparing a show, feeling of, this feeling that you get around May where you start, and directing people, I've really watched people do it, where you start to just grow this fake confidence in your show and in you. And it's bollocks, actually, but you're there going, do you know what, I love this show, I'm so proud of this show, this show's actually a really special
one.
Like, I don't care what happens, but, like, the show, I'm just really proud of this, I'm actually really proud of my work, and I'm actually, like, on fire at the moment. This, you know, you either say it out loud, or you say it to your director, or you say it to your close friends, or you're telling everyone online constantly, feel day or night, whatever, however you deal with your shit, that's bollocks. I really think it's manufactured for self-defence as a kind of armour that you need, but ultimately you get a very different thing. I can't generalise, this is only my experience. I've realised about 7 years in that wasn't real. And why I was doing it, why I was giving myself that blanket, confidence blanket, but that it wasn't really my skin. And I thought, I need to get good enough that that's my skin. And then I've just, in about 3 weeks ago, I've been going for 11 years. And I'd say that about 10, took 10 years. And then I suddenly thought, it wasn't sudden. It was the opposite of sudden. I very gradually realised, it makes me want to puke into my own eyes to say it out loud. And then I thought, I'm good at this.
That's so lovely.
Finally,
that's so great
I deserve to be doing what I'm doing and more. And now I can know, there are very few situations now, finally, where I think I can walk into with a natural confidence, not a veneer, not a swagger, but, you know, a confidence because you're like, I've got this.
Yes.
And it took a decade.
It strikes me very frequently how many people in their first few years of comedy are wanting to get really good really quickly when so many of the elements of comedy have to be in the skin. They've got to be in the bone. Mm-hmm. There's no way. You need to grow.
Yep.
You need to grow. You can't have accelerated growth. There are ways, you know, if you get loads of opportunities, if you get thrown at the deep end in loads of different things. But
I don't think you're happy. Maybe that sounds too rose-tinted and cliche, but I think there's a real stress in the people who, and it's extraordinarily rare, get catapulted fast. There's a stress there because you've got all of the, I suppose it feels like you're going 90 miles an hour, but you hadn't built the car around you very properly.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And that, I mean, that would be just, I feel sympathy and terror on behalf of those people whose careers do that. And you think, I hope they've got the right people around them. I overheard a new act at the weekend talk about somebody and say, they were talking about Jamali Maddox, who's brilliant. I love Jamali. And they were saying, in the early days, no one would touch him because of what he does is so kind of out there and alternative. Like, no one would touch him for almost 3 years. What planet are you on 3 years? He wasn't born. He wouldn't touch himself. Come on. It's not even your puberty.
Do you find that you are intellectually rigorous about stand-up and about your place in it? Because what I'm referring to is a very funny moment in The Silence of the Nans, a recent show of yours, where you talk about the switch in your head. Before you go on to do a gig, you make a conscious decision. I think I've stolen the switch. I don't think you say the switch in my head. I think I've nicked that. You flip the switch. I think I was about to accuse myself of stealing that from the Sylvester Stallone arm wrestling film Over the Top. You flip the switch. You make a conscious decision to enjoy yourself. And I listened to that bit of your show whilst enjoying the show very much and thought, oh, God, that's a good idea. Why don't I do that? That feels like a sort of... it feels emblematic of a mental strength or a clarity to be able to go, I'm going to do that and I'm going to enjoy this.
I think it's a survival technique more than anything. My concern with it is that it's not as visualised as for the sake of explaining it in a show, I turned it into a switch that I flip, and it's not that solid a thing. I don't picture a switch and then put my hand up to it or whatever. Also, I think it makes it... And I don't need to do that because normally it's a very subconscious thing, because normally I still love doing this, so normally I want to be where I am, so I'm going to enjoy it. Ultimately, I'm still at a situation in my career where I have to sometimes be in situations I don't really want to be in, and you do have to manufacture the desire to be there or go, well, what's the worst that can happen? You know, you can do stuff internally, very much intellectually, but it's not just intellectualising, actually. There's a real emotional base to that, to go, I'm going to just enjoy it. Doesn't matter really what happens. And that's as emotional as it is intellectual, making that choice. I did a corporate this Christmas that was just to 10 people who've been on a focus day, who are having their after focus day dinner in the private room of a swanky restaurant in Soho, and I just had to pop in as a surprise... and they're from all around the world. Classic, classic, classic. As a surprise, and just do a little 10 to 15. And it's 10 to 15 minutes, you know, but ultimately all the way there you think. And it was last minute and it was like, oh. Everything else about it was fine in terms of who'd booked me and stuff like that. I knew that ultimately it doesn't really matter what happens. And that's what you've just got to remember. And I got there and I sat upstairs waiting to go down and ta-da. And all your fibres are going, what are you thinking? Like, you don't... This can't work well. And actually, I've got quite good at doing the flip. As soon as I can hear those voices, and they start from the second you have to think about leaving the house to within 10 minutes, all I need is like a 5-10 minute window to turn it round and go, just enjoy yourself. I think if you're watching someone enjoy themselves, it can only be so excruciating, even if you've put the wrong person in the wrong place.
Yes.
Which is what happened on that cruise that show's about. And ultimately, weirdly, in that restaurant gig, can you believe it? Fine. Absolutely fine. Some of them confused. But all it takes of the audience of 10 is two of them to be loving it, and your job's absolutely the victory.
Do you... I don't disagree with that at all. You're a basket case, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think of you, you're one of us, right? Yeah. interested in those...
Oh, the mental health aspect of it.
Those sound like very mentally healthy ways to... process.
I have
and
a lot of CBT.
Yeah, right. Okay, they sound like good CBT. They sound like good. I mean, I couldn't make CBT work for me long term.
Right.
But I probably didn't do enough of it. But they sound like quite good mental jujitsu.
Yeah, they are. To be fair, a therapist didn't give me them. I haven't yet to approach a therapist asking for help with work that practically or with my head around work. The vast majority, I wish I could afford more therapy, but the fortnightly one I have is in large part taken up with helping me, I suppose it's definitely work related, but just cope with I get very overwhelmed very quickly. I try and do way too much. So I'll work on my way to something and then on my way home from it, and then I'll factor way too many things in to do than I can possibly do in a set time frame. And as a result of that, I struggle sometimes. And I think it's one of the reasons I love gigs and podcasts. You can't not be present in them.
Yeah.
You can't
yeah.
drift off in a podcast. I mean, it would be really obvious if you had, but you have to be present in your moment. But to do that in my life, in my time that's mine, to write or to whatever, admin, the admin, but like to have ideas, to be present in the moment as you need to be to have ideas, I need the help of a therapist with. Because otherwise, especially since having a kid so far, I've felt more driven and focused than ever. And I use my time more wisely than ever, but I panic more than ever because that time's been crushed into a block.
And that's really interesting. Well, I don't think I've spoken to anyone about a kind of a recurrent... Do you see that being like a long, long-term process every 2 weeks? This is my top up. This is me popping in for a kind of mental MOT.
As long as I can afford it, I want to have therapy, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I don't see my job getting any less stressful or my life getting any easier anytime soon, because I really love being a parent and I really love my career and I love my work. So I can't... If I'm not going to get off the train, then I'm going to need help along the way and I'm going to have to say yes to all different flavours of help. And without someone telling me to, I won't take breaks.
You won't take breaks?
No, not proper ones.
And why is that? Is it a kind of workaholism?
Yeah, fear, mainly.
Fear of what?
It's fear that I think you get meritocracy drilled into you. I certainly did as a kid. The harder you work, the better you'll do. I think that's through your academic life. That's really pummeled in. And then you get... I've certainly got a big rush of... When I was first falling in love with stand-up, which was an accident, and I will admit this on your podcast, but I wanted to be an actor. I always wanted to be an actor. And I thought, and I If you want to shoot me in the head when you listen to this, ye oldie club comic, you can.
Rest assured, you've done enough hard yards. You're inescapably one of us.
I didn't care about being a stand-up. I wasn't that kid that grew up watching stand-up. I grew up in the countryside. There wasn't any to watch. I'd been to the Comedy Store once on a date that was a disgusting date. I didn't want to be on with a creepy guy that... Anyway, but like, in Freshers Week, I went to see some stand-up. Can't remember the name of them. Can remember one joke, one-liner, American.
What was the joke? Let's work them out.
Oh, the joke was, it was bad. I mean, it was hack AF. It was, it was a Parkinson's joke.
Okay.
His girlfriend. Right. Oh, my things with my girlfriend are a bit shaky. She's got Parkinson's.
Sure.
Oh, and I laughed like
a drain. Let's not try and work out who
it was. I laughed like a drain at 18 years old. But yeah, I never had that thing where I was like, I'm so into stand-up, I've just got to be one. I wanted to be an actor, and I was doing bits and bobs of that, and then my best friend at the time, Sarah Pascoe, started doing stand-up, and I thought, oh, she's making that look quite fun. I might get a decent acting agent. I'll give it a go.
No way! Whoa!
What a
unbelievable
prick.
Pals with Sarah prick. From where? From
improv. Okay. Sarah and Cariad. I wrote some sketches. Yeah, not really. I mean, I wrote badly. I wrote some sketches, and it's a blur actually. But ultimately, I ended up writing some sketches for a live show, going to watch them get acted out, and seeing for the first time in my whole life. I'd never even really taking any notice of whose line is it anyway. I'd seeing short form improv for the first time, asking the guy who was running it all, could I have a go at that? And he said, yeah, don't see why not. So I went to a workshop, and then this workshop became huge, and it was, let's be clear, a fucking appalling. It was called Mixed Nuts because it was meant to be a diverse group. It is mainly white people. but through that group, I met Carrie Ad Lloyd and Sarah Pascoe, and we, along with other people like Paul Foxcroft and Gemma Arrowsmith, and we started our own improvising group called the Institute. And so, yeah, I became friends with them through that. And then Sarah kind of became a traitor and started stand-up.
Yes.
And we were all aspired. And whereas, you know, it's so funny that, you know, and Carrie has gone on to be like one of the best living improvisers of all time. Sarah's flying superstar, you know. And it's so funny to be like, yeah, I probably was copying my brilliant friend and wanted a better exposure as an actor. And within 5 gigs, I was absolutely head over tits in love. Like smack. I felt like I hadn't yet to try smack, maybe one day, but it felt like it was in my veins so fast, and I didn't give a shit about acting, completely let it go for years and years and years, and now I'm really bang into it again, and I love it as much as stand-up. But it took a really saucy affair with stand-up for maybe like 6-7 years before I would put any real sense, serious focus or energy back into wanting to be an actor as well.
And did that energy... Thank you. That's a fantastic origin story. And thank you for having... thanks for being honest about it.
Oh, no.
You know what? I was a mate of Fainsman. So the moment when you thought, I can redabble in acting now, was that because you had become enough of a stand-up to sate the urge that you were kind of like, all right, I can afford to spend any spare time on this now because I'm grounded as a comic?
Yeah, I think there's an element of that, and I can't say that I know for sure. I remember that after I had my son, as in months after I had my son, and I think it coincided with my my agent getting an assistant who was great in terms of castings, but and nothing happened initially, and then I had my son, and I think casting directors think pretty basic terms, and suddenly if someone's able to put you up for young mum roles... Even though, I mean, it's not like you heave the kid out and instantly go, throw these clothes away, get me to next. Do you know what I mean? But suddenly I had like a run of jobs, and weirdly I was getting them, even though I was walking into those rooms objectively, like the sweatiest and fattest. And do you know what I mean? Like the kind of the opposite of all the things you think a glamorous actress or actor should be. Yeah, I didn't give a fuck. I was the happiest I'd been forever. I hadn't slept for ages. I had that Teflon thing where you don't really care. And I was getting parts and stuff. Yeah. So because you're actually doing it, a bit of screen acting, I was like, oh, well, I love it. I love it. And then you think, oh, well, I think I'm allowed this, a bit of polyamory here. I think I'm allowed to love both these things at the same time because they are doable at once you get to a certain point.
So this is Jess. What a joy to speak to her. You can hear how much fun I'm having. You might on one or two occasions hear me stifle a yawn. Please be assured that Jess is also the mother of a young child and completely gave me a pass on how many times I yawned in her face due to having been up since like 4 a.m. or something nuts. I had another killer of those yesterday, but my wife continues in exemplary fashion to do the heavy lifting when it comes to sleeplessness, which I think benefits us all, myself and the wider listenership of the podcast. So praise be to Mrs. Goldsmith. Great fun talking to Jess. As I said, you can go to Next Up Comedy. You can watch her this show that we've been talking about. And if you fancy going to comedianscomedian.com/insiders and joining up for the Insiders Club private podcast, or if you are already a member, you can head over to that feed and you will get access to some extras. I think, is it 15, 20, 30 minutes? Can't remember. A big chunk of extras specifically about directing, because Jess is one of those acts who directs other comics, or certainly has done in the past, and she goes into detail on the process by which she works with a couple of acts she doesn't name, and then a couple of acts she does. She talks about working with Sarah Pascoe, and also with the very exciting newer comedian Lauren Pattinson. So she directed shows for both of those people, with both those people, and you can find all about that if you're interested in some deeper thought and some deeper insight. And if you're one of those people who's sort of passionate about developing your career, then maybe the Insiders Club is for you. That's a good place to get hold of that stuff. Also, the latest episode of Comedy Critique has just recently gone up there. And that latest episode features feedback for last episode's guest, Christian Talbot. And it also is an opportunity for feedback for Laura McMahon. Two very interesting, very funny acts there. So get stuck into that if you're in the Insiders Club. If you'd like to join the ComCom Facebook group, you can rack up some questions for forthcoming guests, including Police Cops, who I'm doing live at Vault Festival this coming Friday. I hope you can make it along. Oh, no, I'm not. They're on Friday. And then I'm interviewing them at 4 p.m., 4:30 p.m. on Saturday as part of Vault Festival. I hope you'll go along to that. If you'd like to ask them questions in advance, you can do that at the Comedians Comedian Facebook group. And you can also, who have we got coming up? Jeff Innocent. I've been trying to get Jeff Innocent. We've been trying to make our diaries work for about 3 years. And Jeff Innocent, absolute. I mean, God, what is he? He's just a... I would certainly never dream of describing him as an ageing warhorse, as I did Mike Wilmot so memorably. But he has been in the game for a good long while. He has a fantastic perspective on comedy. He has an incredible amount of experience of just crushing gigs. And I don't use that very American phrase lightly. He really does kill. So if you'd like to put in a question there for Jeff Innocent, I will create a thread for doing that at the ComCom Facebook group. There is now also a spoiler thread for discussion of Kitson's new show. So I've not seen it. I've not been engaged in the spoiler thread, but it's all safeguarded. You can turn off notifications for it and stuff. There's no visible spoilers, but that's a really good use of the group. So if you fancy doing that, then pop along there. Forthcoming stuff, of course, we have, as well as the Police Cops live one, on the 23rd of March in Birmingham at the Town Hall as part of the podcast festival there. We have an amazing live special coming up, so jump on that and sell your tickets. It's selling pretty well. I know it will sell better when I release the name of the guest, but I'm just dotting the I's and crossing the T's. All right, trust me, it'll be great. Buy a ticket. More exciting people coming up soon as well. I'll name them once they're safely in the can. And honestly, people who keep asking about the K. Trevor Wilson episode, I'm trying. I've got like 9 hard drives and I'm going through all of them thinking, have I renamed the file something? I'm trying to work out the date I recorded it, all of that tedious stuff. I will find it, I promise. Chat to you a little bit afterwards. For now, let's get back to my conversation with Jessica Fosterkey.
What are your favourite things? What sorts of things?
Being in someone's radio pilot, being a comedian who adores radio pilot, being asked to write for it, but the sheen's come off that now. I still love writing on things, but I'm at a point now where I'm like, oh yeah, I'll write on that for a day. Can I be on it? I'm ready. Yeah. I'm ready to break that. That's my next bit of ceiling to smash, really, be on more things. But acting work, it's had absolutely nothing to do with Edinburgh's and being getting on the radar of producers for doing things as a comedian on radio and telly, one in 10 things I've done has been from an Edinburgh. Tops. It's not as important as it for me as it used to be. Weirdly, as Edinburghs get easier, because one, you find the longer you've been going, the easier you find it to write an hour of stuff, the easier you find it to get people in the room, whatever. But my work has come from podcasting more than Edinburgh's.
How long have you been doing? Oh, yeah, because well, it's not just who.
No, co-hosting The Guilty Feminist.
Yes.
Yeah.
How long? Are you the regular co-host or a regular
there's
co-host?
There's a regular. I'm not regular anymore. Yeah, yeah. I had a flurry of doing it quite often, but yeah, now there's tons of us.
And that show's enormous, mm-hmm. and suddenly your name is out there in a way that, I mean, I found that when I started podcasting. Yeah. I'd look at the numbers of people who'd listen to me describe my day at the end of a thing and go, oh, that's more people than I played to in two Edinburghs.
Yeah. But then that eventually translates to Edinburghs. Yeah.
So if you're not getting the work from Edinburgh,
yeah,
what's the attraction of doing Edinburgh when you do it?
God, that's so interesting because
because
to have a presence up there and for the love of doing a show, it ultimately comes down to the romantic fundamentals that you have to be doing it for not to lose your mind up there. I think. I mean, I fell for all the traps that everyone falls for in my first 2 years. I threw away many, many thousands of pounds in a paid venue, fleeced by producers. I just lost so much money. I borrowed money from friends. I was really careful about how I funded them, so I never ruined my life. I never Michael McIntyre'd it and got in with debtors, but I...
Did he do that? I've not heard that.
Yeah, he got 30 grand of Edinburgh debt and had bailiffs around. That's why he hates bailiffs. That's why, did you hear he booked to do a corporate to bailiffs?
Oh, yes, I did.
And then
he didn't
show.
Yeah.
Because they'd ruined his life.
Lad.
Yeah. Player. So, yeah, the desire now goes back. So I did all of that in the first few years, and then I had a big fall from grace. So I was like, big rebel, no, fuck this. I'm going on the free fringe where I'd done my shared shows and then had really good fun there for a couple of years, completely unnoticed, but playing to full rooms, having a great time, but absolutely no industry knowing I was there. And then now I'm somewhere back in that third middle ground where I want to be at, you know, I don't want to go back to the free fringe anymore. I'm still not sure I want to risk the hemorrhaging of money that is going to the big four. So I'm in the world of the £5 or £6 and pay what you want.
Okay.
Venues, of which there were sort of 2.5, right? So it's Monkey Barrel and Just the Tonic and Gilded Balloon some years. So, yeah, I don't want to lose loads and loads of money. I don't mind losing a little bit. But because it hasn't been the thing that's really kicked me it up to the next level in terms of exposure of radio and telly, I've got no desire to lose, you know, five figures up there. No fucking way, never again. I think it's sick. It makes me fucking rage that people feel like they have to do that. It's a con. I'm still so angry about it. Just from those first 2 years, and that was 2011 and 2012. Like, it's not fair. It's ridiculous that people are doing that. Because ultimately, I'm a lefty, and it pains me, because it means if you're loaded, you can do that again and again and again until people are noticing you. It's not how it should be.
Talking about the Silence of the Nans, which was 2017,
yeah,
which is an excellent show. So I listened to it whilst bouncing my reflux-addled baby on my chest for an hour. And I tell you what, in the dark, bouncing a baby, great way to enjoy the audio of an hour of comedy. I was like, there's actually most of the comedy I listen to now is while I'm travelling, because who has the time to sit and watch a thing anymore? And actually, in a darkened room, really worked. It was like that thing we talked about, the dining experience in the dark. So that show, I said to you afterwards, I texted you immediately and was like, what a refreshing, that story structure. There was about 20 minutes in where I thought, I hope it's just this big one story. Yeah. And it was!
The
story of you having this awful pair of gigs on a cruise ship. In the writing of that story, show number 5...
Yeah.
And having not, with apologies, having not seen your previous hours, is that structure or something you always use?
Because no, it made me go,
I really want to do one big story. Yeah. What can I talk about? Because it's really Moorish.
As soon as I got back from that cruise, which is the silver lining on it, really, I was like, oh, I think I have to tell this as one huge story. I've met so many funny people.
The characterisation.
Yeah, there were so many. But also, I didn't even get a chance to include the staff that I met on there that weren't in entertainment. The people that were working as chefs and waiters and, you know, cleaners. It was an incredible community on there. Like, and actually, how people spoke to them. It's just so disgusting. It was this crazy microcosm. But actually, I thought, no, there's a world that I can paint. There's all these characters. And that's the other
it's
thing.
It's on a ship. It's a bottle episode.
Yeah, totally. Do you know what I mean?
That's the entire world.
But also the other thing is, I think for years I've shied away. I think I remember having I'll tell you who it was. It was Peter at the downstairs at the King's Head. And I was about five gigs in and Peter said to me,
He said, you need to decide,
are you an actor or are you a stand-up? Because you won't get on in this if you're an actor. Actress, he probably said. So, that sunk in. And it's only half helpful because it meant that, you know, even probably a few years ago, I wouldn't have admitted on this podcast that I went into this for not horrible reasons. Why is there shame in it? For like an undercover actor.
Yeah.
Wanting to be a stand-up. Because when I started, that was, you would get spat at by some experienced comedians at gigs because they would be like, how dare you? There was a flux. There must have been an influx of actors or drama school leavers coming into comedy there, and they were loathed. So I've been hiding. Not that I've trained actor, but I've been hiding that desire to do that for ages. And it took me to 2017, 9 years of doing stand-up, to go, use it if you can act. Be the characters. In the characters. But you're telling the story as a stand-up. And you're not just a story. Not there's anything wrong with them. You get amazing storytellers. But, you know, you still come to it with the writing of a stand-up. It still has to meet certain benchmarks of funniness and rhythms. And there's still set pieces within it, although very few. But it's a thing of such joy to tell one massive story. And I'm not doing that this year with this new show because the downfall to it is I don't think people watch it and go, oh yeah, we could take that 10 minutes and put it in our thing.
Of course.
I think I'll do alternate, but it was so satisfying. Honestly, I can't tell you how satisfying it was. And I think, not that I will ever do anything as regimented as going, I'll do this every other year, whatever, but ultimately I will mix it up. I'll definitely do story shows in the future as well because it's really fun.
The clarity was great. It was so... I felt it lasted no time at all because it was so simple. I loved it. I just loved it. Your characterisation is absolutely great. So you're not a trained actor.
No.
So how come you're an actor? What's that about? I thought you had to go to drama school. You were an actor?
No, you're a big show-off. I did a play at school kind of by accident because one of my friends was doing... Because my beautiful, successful blonde friend, Maya. I think there's a pattern. I copied my friend, Maya.
I'm so glad you pointed out that potential pattern.
Oh, God.
I would not like to be sitting here going, do not mansplain this.
No, there's a pattern. I follow my friend. She auditioned for a play at school, a new play called Ozzy and the Thwarts. And I think I was nine, and I auditioned. She got to be the villain, like the Cruella de Vil, and I got to be her henchman. I can't even... Grovel.
Nice.
Its name was. It was a genderless character, very modern, actually, for however long ago it was. Anyway, I loved it, and I loved getting laughs, and I loved being all contorted, and I now look back and realise it was an absolute 100% rip-off impression of Rick Mayall, who I adored.
Who didn't start their career ripping off Rick Mayall?
I did, and I still think in my more impish moments, I'm channeling him. I watched the film Drop Dead Fred every day for a year around that age. I was obsessed with it. It's that naughty, make-believe character. But also, my parents are, if anything, far too liberal, so I was already fully au fait with Blackadder and Bottom as well. So just all that kind of kind of grotty, creepy, mucky.
It's really it's funny because part of the joy of the characterization is that in the show is that they're all grotesques,
yeah,
which is exactly that. And you love that's really funny, of course, Rick Mayall, because you love playing against your very smooth, creamy radio. Did you used to do weather? Did you used to do traffic on the radio?
Yeah,
you've got a fantastic radio voice, right? And it's kind of. I would guess people who end up doing traffic on the radio, I would guess you specifically, part of the makeup, the genetic makeup of that job was the fact that you're a really warm, reassuring vocal presence.
Well, maybe, yeah. I think I was pretty shit at doing the traffic, though.
Well, maybe, yeah.
It was really early morning starts, and I quite often would have been out quite late the night before and come in and be like, there's not a lot happening on the M6.
But you love, in your shows, you love playing against that because as a comic, I think you are all of our friend. You're the host of the party.
Yeah.
You're very warm and welcoming. And the very first moment in that show when you do 2 minutes of crowd work and go, that's finished, I hate it, which is lovely. It's sort of a lovely introduction to you. The difference between this sort of warm Radio 4 voice and then the kind of grovel, the kind of like that, it's really fun. It's really fun to play off. And you also get tremendous breadth of characterization out of the different people on the ship. It's a really, I think it's a real achievement.
Thanks, kindy.
It doesn't lead to a question, does it? Do you ever deliberately insert characterisation? Is that something that you'll go to if you're going, what does this bit need? Oh, there's a space for a character there. Or is it simply that it just naturally bubbles out of you?
Naturally bubbles out. I'm not actor enough. I'm more stand-up than actor. And I think I'm not actor enough to go, oh, what would they talk like? And I don't make someone up from scratch. There has to have been a person. There has to have been someone, or there has to be someone at least I can put in that position where I can be like, I'm going to... And sometimes I'll... I know it happens organically because I've been told regularly now, because I talk about my son so much in my comedy at the moment, that I have quite a specific voice and face that I go into when I'm talking about, when I'm being him.
Okay.
And I didn't even know I was doing that.
Do the
really.
Voice, please.
Oh, God, I don't know if I can on cue. No, I don't think I can. Okay, sorry, okay, I don't think I can. I was like, oh, God, I'm really panicking. I don't think I can. But he's, but I only know it because so I'll be talking with a friend and talking about something and they'll go, oh, my God, when you were talking then, you just did your own impression of Rudy. And I'll be like, oh, did I? I haven't, okay. So I think perhaps it's something I do socially. So,
yes.
You know, if I'm talking about somebody who's from Glasgow and I'll say that they're saying something, then I might do a Glaswegian accent while I'm saying what they said to you. So
sure.
I think if I'll do that, it's more organic than written.
And I was going to ask a follow-up question about the decisions you make in writing, the non-characterised stuff, the stand-up stuff, when you said this kind of set pieces, the kind of premise-based stand-up. However, I was slightly put off by remembering your bit about effing and jeffing, where you say jeffing is... What is it? It's drawing a face on an egg and taking it on an item.
According to Urban Dictionary.
Oh, is that written? That's an actual... Yeah. I didn't know whether you'd made that one up or not. Yeah. I love that bit.
It's so funny, isn't it? With the story show, I'd say I just had to be super conscious and not overwriting it. Because ultimately... As much as you have creative license, it's not a, you know, it's not a TED talk, it's not a medical seminar. You can lie all the fucking that you want. You can lie the tits off the face off the thing. And in fact, that took me years to learn. Absolutely years
to learn.
That
is interesting.
I was so, because I like to have this nut of truth or seed of truth at the beginning of every bit that I'll do. Even if it's just the beginning of what my opinion used to be, a person or a thing that happened or whatever, more often than not, an awful thing that happened, whatever, or an ostensibly awful thing, or something where an expectation was mismatched. This year, I'm going to talk about my birth story because there's a massive, it's a horrific story, but there's a mismatch of expectation, which is ultimately what the cruise was. I had very naive expectations. Well, you know, I had expectations that it would be this, this and this, and it turned out to be... enough of this, that and that. And the same thing happened giving birth to my son. So I think, it's a funny thing with writing. I also found that since having a kid, I've used my time like a shark now. But I also don't like with stand-up, I don't like sitting down and writing things out long form like I used to. It doesn't feel like, well, me, I can't work out whether I've either worked out it's not very efficient use of my time, or if it's just my process has changed. I've no idea which is, but I certainly much more. Oh, and the confidence, the growth in confidence, so you can just go on stage with an idea now, or even a punchline, or something where, you know, I like that comparison, and I'd rather talk it out again and again and again at 20 new material gigs now than sit down with a pen and paper and sit there staring at it.
I don't disagree with any of that, and I've certainly found the same myself. I hadn't thought about it. It's definitely a reaction to far less time now, now that we're both parents. I find that I do lots of writing driving to a gig, listening back to a preview, and pausing it and going, okay, look, I'll add that and I'll add that, you know.
Yeah.
Far more of that. That's so much more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's all at the end of the day. It's just efficiency, isn't it? You've got to get the stuff down. It's got to come out. But I just wanted to stay with that idea of truth. I think I probably started from a point of view of this all has to be true. And or completely clearly fanciful, you know, like couldn't possibly be true,
and just has to be plausible. It doesn't have to be true.
Well, I think I'm a little bit, it's funny, I think I'm still a bit it's got to be true, but I think I probably bend the truth more than I like to admit. And I'm listening to you go, that's plausible, and I'm going, yeah, I suppose you're right. I suppose if I'm honest with myself.
Well, look, I mean, in terms of that Silence of the Nan show, everything that everyone said, they said. Their voices might be changed slightly or whatever, but that's how I will remember them forever now. Or it's how you know. And the things that happened. We were thrown out of the swimming pool, all those little events. But the timelines changed. Actually, it was both the gigs in reality were on the same night.
Oh, Lord.
But then I was trapped at sea for... To get an ending, a satisfying, victorious ending, took fabrication.
Yes.
Because ultimately, I had all the kind of empowering victory for me came after the fact in writing a show I'm happy with about it. It didn't come of tumbling out of me at a gig, actually, that I'd had half an hour to reset about. And there were things I couldn't even fit in the show that happened that I wish I could, but because I'd had to put the second gig days later and not half an hour later.
Yes.
So there, Kathleen, who's a character in the show, who's a real person who worked on there, who was just...
Was it all real names? Yeah. Can you use everyone's real name?
Yeah, I did actually. I had to be really careful because there's a rival entertainer on the ship who I've had to since go back to and realise I should have asked...
Yeah.
I should have asked. I asked to use some of her music, and she not unfairly said, I always want to help another performer out, but she'd had people on cruises coming up to her saying, do you know someone's talking about you in their comedy show, which terrified me, and I felt awful, like real proper tangy. I feel really emotional thinking about it. Tangy old guilt. I should, before I was ever going to use her real name, have emailed her. I mean, I got in touch and bought her CD and stuff, but I should have emailed her and said, may I? So anyway, she said, no, of course you could. I mean, I would let you use my music, but I can't be seen to be endorsing anything that's even faintly rude about cruises because that's her livelihood sack her.
Yeah,
and she was a good egg, and I hope she comes out of it well enough. Oh, God, because in reality, I never met her.
That is so interesting, isn't it? Because what we're talking about is truth, and hey, it just has to be plausible, but they're real people.
These are real people.
And she's a real person who, although not in our industry, is in a parallel, entertainment, the
parallel
broader
universe,
church.
Actually. Yeah. Yeah. It'll be all right. What I was going to say is that Kathleen, who was like the one who kind of like, who was your kind of act liaison, who spoke like that, like so dead inside. And one line which I wish I could have put in the show, but I couldn't because I'd made the two gigs too far apart from each other. But she said to me, I said just before I went on the second gig, I went, do I have to do, is there a sort of, do you want me to do 45 minutes again? And she said, oh, no, I'm not, No, you don't have to do as long this time. And I said, oh, good. I said, is there a lower limit? And she went, not if it goes the same as the last show.
Oh, my God.
And that was the last thing I heard seconds before going on. Oh, it's just like, mate. Twist of the knife. Like, oh my God. But yeah, no, I feel really guilty about not checking in with that entertainer who was on board before about using their real name.
Did it, in the writing of it, did it occur to you, I could just change your name? Or was it important to you? But given that the truth doesn't matter.
No, that's exactly one of the things. I mean, when I said I get overly tied to the truth and it's taken me years to realise I don't have to, as in, I will tell... So I think the reason why that Magneto bit never got good is because it came in the middle of a story about my car breaking down.
Yeah.
And I stuck to the events. If I'd come at it like a stand-up, a writer, and not a raconteur telling your life story, I could have made that much funnier. You know, that's 5 years ago. Is it laziness? Is it... this dedication to the truth, whatever. But no, in a far more practical sense, again, this was just, I'll keep everyone's names in. It was a mixture of naivety and I'd say 10% wanting to keep it true, 10% laziness, and 80% genuinely lack of ambition, not thinking that, well, how will any of them ever find out about it? Sure.
I thought you were going to say 80% revenge.
No. I toured that show, but I didn't know I'd be able to. I went to that Edinburgh and had my best Edinburgh so far. You know, it's still not, as in, you know, the roof stayed on, but I've really enjoyed myself for the first time. Didn't have to worry about numbers for the first time. Definitely the best show I've done so far, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then that finishes in September, and then you're like, oh, I get to do a tour in January, my first ever tour. And I didn't know, I still was shocked that I couldn't believe that also, who the fuck is aware what I'm doing, who also goes on cruises and who's going and telling her? Oh, I had no idea that I'd so detached that world, because it was like going to another planet
and it's
back in
boat.
Time. Yeah, that you forget that they're real people, that you forget it's a real place, and that anyone who's anything to do with that might ever find out what you're doing talking about them. I just had no idea it would ever go that far. But it's no excuse. I mean, never again would I risk that. Just change the bloody name. Just change the name to Janet or something.
Do you feel, as a comic, do you feel humble?
Humble, yeah, I suppose. It's so weird. It's taken me so long to get confident. I feel like I'd be a fraud to say I feel humble. But I feel humility. I think, if anything, I overprize humility.
And maybe that would be a better way of asking the question.
I think, if anything, I really hold humility dear, to the extent that I'm pretty sure it's held my career back. Because there's been situations where I think if I spoke about how great I think I can do, how well I think I can do something, or how great things are going, I would have got further on, and I cannot bear to do that. And I think anyone who enjoys that is a terrible, awful cunt, and I don't want to spend any time with them. And I fucking hate the way that it's now kind of, we sort of have to on social media. The kids started doing it. The young ones started doing it. Look at my sellout this. Look at my this, that, the other. Aren't I amazing? And now, a little bit, you got to do it. You got to fucking do it. And it breaks my heart. But what I would never do is make my output on those places entirely that. There has to be some comedy in there too. We're not reality TV stars. We're meant to be comedians. We're not just
turning
products.
Into reality TV,
it
isn't
is
it?
But it's bollocks. You have to be funny first and foremost. You're not a brand. You're not a queen. You're not you're a fucking comedian. Be funny. You're allowed a percentage of your time promoting yourself. But if that is all you do, and if you post things that other people have said about you, if you retweet that, goodbye. Especially during any festival. Okay. I can't bear to see it. I can't bear it. It makes me feel sick. Also, to me, it just screams of lack of confidence. You can't tell people what you're doing. Don't tell people how great other people think you are.
Does that still count when promoting your podcast?
No. It's not me, is it? It's a product.
Yeah, and I think
it's entirely my issue. I have a disgust, an innate disgust when it comes to the idea of promoting myself. Yeah. I will promote my gigs and my podcasts and my whatever. I will promote them to the hell and heaven and everything. But to go, please, please love me. And that's where stand-up's so unique, because that's what you're doing, really. Makes me absolutely wretchy.
I suppose I don't know if that's kind of where I don't know if that's an excellent answer. I don't know where my question came from, except maybe there's a thing
you've probably seen my podcast retweet.
No, it's not to do with social media. Like the question about humility is what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
And I suppose I think of, when I think, oh, that time I saw you 5 years ago, I thought, wow, she's gone up a gear. Maybe you weren't singing your praises, singing your own praise. You know, behave like, I think, people who started around the time I started.
Yeah.
When it was, I've said this on the show before, I felt like the tail end of people who were doing it as an alternative lifestyle as opposed to be wanting to be a millionaire.
Yeah.
You know,
I still don't want to be a millionaire.
No.
Oh, actually, do you know what? £1 million isn't that much anymore. I wouldn't mind. I feel like we need to change that to billionaire now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, millionaire's like owns property within zone 6 if you live in London, yeah.
I think I think of sometimes of Tom Stade when he was on this show years ago now, saying, if you want to be, and I wish I could do a good Tom Stade because he's got such a good voice for impressions, but if you want to be a star, fucking act like one.
Mm.
And I don't act like I'm a star. I don't act like I want to be a star, and I don't think you do either.
I don't ever want to. But I don't think that means you don't get to be one. It depends what you want. Also, what I want is always changing. But I've had a really funny thing recently where I've realised I don't need... Like, watching The Guilty Feminist go the way it's gone and become so enormous. And I've watched lots of friends tip into very extraordinary levels of success. I've watched what it's done to them. I've watched how they've coped with it or not. I've watched how much happier they are. They're not. Whatever. It's what fascinates me. And this might change, but at the moment, I've been thinking, I don't think I want an army. I don't want a whole... like Lady Gaga's got an army, The Guilty Feminist has got an army. I'm not disparaging the people that do want that, and I'm not certainly disparaging the armies. They're great. These are great, iconic things. But I don't know what that comes with. I remember it was Sarah Millican as well. What that comes with is certain expectations and a brand, you know. Then, okay, well, this is what I do. It's whatever. For Sarah Millican, I kind of had to do a thing of going, it's jolly, it's happy, it's kind of cheeky but not too rude. And she'd have to start doing a disclaimer at tour shows. Actually, what I do in live stuff's a lot ruder than what you might see on the telly.
Sure.
Or on Twitter.
Yeah.
And with The Guilty Feminist, extraordinarily right on, inclusive is the right... was the model to it. It's set its stall out as being a social justice movement that is 100% inclusive. And within that, there will be failings, but the promise is out there to try.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at that and I look at all the other examples I've got and think, yeah, I'm not interested in having an army. I want loads and loads of people to come to my shows. I want a profile that means I get to do the fun things that I actually want to do on the radio and the television. And I want to work constantly as an actor, and I want to get good. I don't just want 3 lines in things. I want to be the interesting part. You know, I want to be looked at and I want to be noticed. But I don't think superstardom and arenas is, still not sure that's my end game. I hope that doesn't show a lack of ambition. Well, I just actually really want I want a fucking lovely life. And I want to keep doing the things I love and to be noticed for it. But I don't think I need a whole army of people. I don't think I want to be worshipped in that way that some people, when they get extraordinarily successful, are. I think I might find that a bit terrifying.
And we do know people who we know well people who we have seen accelerate into that kind of world. And does it make them happier? Sometimes it must do.
We have to live in a world. We have to live in a head where the things we want are the things we want. Otherwise, you have no impetus for trying. You know, you have to want. But I think there's nothing wrong with being realistic about it. I think you can. There's a difference between saying I want the life of Beyonce and I want the life of, what's a good example? Frankie Boyle.
Yeah.
Frankie Boyle, Romesh.
Yeah.
Two people who I say at the moment getting to do whatever they want. Whatever they want gets made. I'm sure
from
neither
the outside.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure from our perspective, do you know what I mean? I guess when you're in that place, I'm sure
yeah,
there are
maybe there's frustrations, yeah. Yeah. I whatever, you know, I think that roughly that's the point where I think, yeah, lovely, absolutely lovely. Probably paying like 2,000-3,000 seaters. That's huge, actually, isn't it? But still, like, oh, I don't know. You're taking your life at your pace. You've got your family. You're getting to enjoy your family. I'm sure neither of them are skint. And I'm sure, you know, there's probably... I suppose it's just a little bit of... I don't know. It's a real minefield. I feel like what I want on that front in terms of being honest and going, well, you must want... I remember being with a very successful friend when... We just couldn't get out of the toilet because everyone that came out of a cubicle wanted their autograph, wanted their picture with them. And we were doing our makeup in a toilet. Mm. And she was so lovely to all of them. And I was like, how are you coping? And she said, it's what we wanted, isn't it? It's what I always wanted. So I've got to enjoy it. And I still always question whether or not I do want that. What if you needed a poo? What if you'd needed a poo in that same toilet and all those people in there knew who you were?
Yeah.
I think you get really terrible stomach problems from all the pictures you were holding in. Poor, poor famous people with their terrible IBS. That's because you're in their toilet with them. I don't know, yeah. I mean, I definitely want more success than I've got so far, but perhaps there's a cap on it, is my point. I don't think I necessarily want to... The best way to put it that I can stick to and mean it is I don't think I necessarily want to take over the world.
Yeah.
I just want to do really fucking well.
Is there any part of your kind of regular CBT routine which is to do with success?
Yes.
And is there any particularly useful thing you could share with us that's kind of... a way of dealing with that? Like, one of the things that my guy used to say was dare to be average.
That's lovely.
To be average. Stop trying to, you know, huge problems with perfectionism for me, which I seem I haven't entirely solved. They bother me less now. And it's not about me, this one. So that little things like that, are there any particular things that crop up that you find yourself applying in a day-to-day?
God, I'm going to really think about it. The one practical thing that I can remember was during a really breakdowny time, which I get into quite often because I just get overwhelmed. I like take on tons of stuff at once, and then it's like my heart's pounding and I'm stressed to the point of I can't focus on anything and everything panics me. And when I get into one of those ruts, she sort of really carefully makes me pare it back, but does it helps me to do it really gradually in a way where I don't feel like I've had to suddenly cancel everything so far. But in the midst of one of those, and I was saying I was gigging that night, and I think it was an important gig, and you know, she'd been quite clear about, do you actually have to do it? What would happen if you didn't do it? And I'd manically been quite like, well, this won't happen and that won't happen. And I really didn't, you know, I really wanted to do the gig. And she said, well, in that case, you've got to remember that in that situation, while your mental health is like this and you're vulnerable up there, you are a performative version of you up there, one thing you could do is visualise an armour on you. Like, visualise your clothes as armour, ultimately, and see if that makes you feel a bit safer before you're actually on stage. And, you know, I don't think I ever did it. Because, actually, on stage is already safe, because I'm safe from my own head, because you're in the moment and you're focused. And, actually, That's interesting. But that's interesting in itself, I think. But yeah, that was her advice. I wonder if that might be helpful for someone else. It sounded great at the time.
I like the idea, but I'm more interested in the idea that you don't need that because you're safe on stage.
Yeah.
I wonder how many of us that's true for.
Mm.
I feel like most of the time, if it's, you know, if it's working,
yeah,
which it is most of the time,
yeah,
you're in a state of flow,
mm,
and you think, great, this is, I'm happy now.
Yeah.
I'm not thinking about,
you know. You're not, you haven't got time to stop and think about the past and the future
and all the other things.
Yeah. No, you have to be in the moment. That's what I mean. You're in, yeah, the moment.
It forces,
you're necessarily,
you into the moment,
in the moment. I think it's why lots of stand-ups, infuriatingly for trained actors, get seen for some quite interesting acting. Casting director put it really neatly to me once, is that stand-ups as a rule tend to be really good at being in the moment, being very present in the conversation, in the performance, because that's what we do. And you can still be a terrible actor. but you know, yeah.
Are you happy?
Yeah, I am. God, that's such a huge question. Are you happy? Yeah, I'm really happy. I'm very grateful. I'm really grateful. There's elements. You mean my career? Just generally. He's done a really smirky face, if you're listening.
Oh, no, smirky,
but, no, not smirky face. Cheeky face, kind of like,
well,
you work out what
say.
I mean. I feel very grateful for all sorts of things in my life. I mean, I'm ultimately extraordinarily privileged, full stop. I'm a white middle class person. And I'm not loaded, but, you know, I won't be homeless if everything changed tomorrow. Well, I mean, unless there's an apocalypse and we're all homeless. I mean, that could happen to anyone. I feel very happy to be a parent. And then when it comes to my career, there's elements. And in my whole life, there's stuff I still want that I haven't got yet. So I'm satisfied, like, ultimately. I'm not like, I haven't peaked. I've got a way old to go. I want to get, I've got a bunch better at comedy that I want to get, and acting that I want to get. There's loads of little career things, or big career things, that I still really want that I haven't got yet. I feel closer to them than ever before, and that feels real and not just imagined for once. So maybe there's a lot of happiness in that. And I have lots of moments of unhappiness, but they tend to be, maybe I'm very lucky with that, actually. They tend to be felt as stress as opposed to sadness or anxiety. But I need to learn what anxiety is. It could well be anxiety. So, you know, I'm not like one of those people who's gleeful all the time. But if I look at the grand picture, I feel a general contentment and gratitude. Yeah, I think things are going the way I want.
That's a lovely answer.
But I feel like I've earned them, and they've taken ages. Do you know what I mean? I don't feel, yeah. I feel like I'm still grafting hard. And I'll never not graft hard. But it's a long game, and that doesn't stress me out anymore. That it's it's such a cliche, but you've got to enjoy the game. It's not about the results. It's got to enjoy the game. Because actually, I had a really, so here's a nice thing. It encapsulates it, I think. I had, my dad used to work for a champagne company, Moët & Chandon, and I had a bottle of Dom Perignon from the year I was born, 1983, that was a gift from him, the year before he got made redundant. And so I had this extraordinarily posh and special drink. And this was pre-starting comedy. When I first got it, I said, you know what, I'm going to drink that when I get my first paid gig. And then you get your first paid gig and you think, fuck that, you know, that's not good enough. And then you go, no, make it something bigger. I'm going to drink that when I get my first agent. And then you do your first agent, you know, and you're like, okay, well, actually, oh, surprise, it didn't change much. And then you go, you know, the goals kept bigging and bigger and bigger and bigger. And then it got to the point where I wasn't even noticing that the goals had been achieved. And I wasn't even having the thought. I just occasionally look at that bottle and think, why are you fucking drinking that? And it's because I was behaving like someone who was never, ever satisfied, ever going to be happy with that. So 2 weeks after my son was born, I just drank it with some friends who love champagne. And I'm never going to treat something like that again. That it's, you've got to live your life now, live it now. It's so cliche, but you just got to. And I think that's how you get to be happy. If you don't get to be happy, if you're like, I'll be happy when I've got this award, or I'll be happy when I've got this Oh, and also, I don't really believe in prizes and awards, but that's a whole bigger other thing. But, you've got to enjoy the thing while it's happening. Otherwise, you won't be happy.
Thanks, man.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So that was Jessica. Thank you to her for coming on the show. Thank you very much to you for listening to it, for supporting the show by joining the Insiders Club at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, and indeed getting hold of those juicy extra bits from the show. This particular one, this section is about Jessica's work directing, amongst others, Sarah Pascoe and Lauren Pattinson. So really worth a listen if you're in the club. If you'd like to go to comedianscomedian.com/tour, you can find out where I'm going to be doing some stand-up near you soon. That show, End Of, is an absolute joy to perform. I've been warming up bits of it, ready to go back on tour since last Edinburgh, since its last proper run. And I've got some lovely, lovely venues coming up. This is like a mini tour because of the birth of Future Girl, and it's a little bit closer to home, but it will be extended wildly beyond the realms of my imagination later this year when we do a much bigger version of the tour around the rest of the country in autumn-ish. Edinburgh news. I think I'm going to Edinburgh. You know, I was all wondering about it last time. Pretty sure I'm going to Edinburgh. Pretty sure I'm doing an excellent small room in a venue I've played but never done a whole run at. And it's a glorious, glorious room. And it's a glorious club. And I think I'm going to... It's not all signed yet, but I'm pretty sure I'm going to be up there sans famille and enjoying working hard away from the fam and podcasting my bum off and... just really swimming around in the Edinburgh Festival. That is going to be happening, I think. Don't quote me, but I think it's going to happen this year. So more details on that later. Let's just get out of here, do some thankses, and then I've got a little thing to tell you about in the postamble. Thanks, as ever, to Nathan Wood for editing and uploading the show, to Rob Smouton for the music. Peter Dobbing was the podcast consultant. And who else? Angel Comedy. Yes, angelcomedy.co.uk. Let's imagine. I'm sure it's that. But it's a fantastic venue in Angel in North London at a pub there called The Bill Murray. So get yourself along to that. Where I saw Rory Scovel. Oh, my God, he was incredible. What did he do, like an hour 15 or something? And one of those people, he's just so, like, it's such a great time to see him now because he's really going off. He's had this show, what was it called? It's something like Rory Scovel Tries Comedy for the First Time is the name of his special on Netflix. But he's just, it's so richly layered, joke, big routine. And the lovely, my favourite bits are all the lovely little trills and asides and jokes about comedy and jokes about the process in between. But none of that feels laboured. It's just so kind of, nor does it feel kind of smooth or slick. You just feel like you're just getting a real person really telling you what's going on in their life. And it feels conversational and intimate, but then he'll just flip a gear and just annihilate. I cannot recommend him enough. I've not seen that Netflix special yet. I've seen other specials of his. But Rory, and then it's S-C-O-V-E-L. Please do yourself a favour and look him up. Also saw some incredible new material from Eddie Izzard, but you don't need me to tell you how wonderful he is, or indeed how wunderbar, because that's his new tour that he's beginning, like, going everywhere in the world in 2 weeks or whatever it is. Everywhere in the world for the next 2 years. Before then, I don't know if you knew this, he said on stage that then I'm going to go into politics. Don't know if that means he's pressing pause on comedy, but that'll be fascinating to watch. That was all good stuff. I'll have a brief postamble with you. Here's some snuffling from Future Girl. Can you hear that? She went quiet then. She just completely stopped in that way that babies do to pretend they've stopped breathing. That's all of that, and I will postamble at you in just a moment. Thanks for listening. Apologies once again for the slightly low timbre of my voice this time as I bounce a snoozing child in a baby carrier around a dark room. Lovely talking to you. Speak to you soon. So by way of a tiny little postamble, I am experiencing, or have very recently, today, been experiencing, my friend Andre is a parent, and he's, if you've seen the show End Of, he is one of the couple in the Shackleton bit that some of you know and like. He's a dear, dear friend of mine. His son is my godson. I've known him years and years. And he always talked, when his children were very young, about this kind of rush of joy. He would just be very good at sort of evoking this incredible happiness about parenthood. And this is an unashamed parenting postamble this time, because it is my boy's birthday. It's the Boutros's third birthday tomorrow. Yeah, I know, right? You remember me talking in these postambles about getting pregnant and having a child and stuff. Well, he's three. What the hell? He's going to be three tomorrow. That's a Monday. So today on the Sunday, we had an improvised, a planned, but improvisational treasure hunt ending in a secret forest disco. Yeah, we're fucking hipsters. Get over it. And it was so joyful. And it was just one of those moments that Andre used to describe where you're just kind of hanging on. You know, if you write in capital letters HGNNNNN, it's like, you can't cope with the joy flooding through you. It was so glorious. And why doesn't anyone do, like, this is, we've invented a thing and you can have this. This is a treasure hunt for kids, right? But so that you don't need to set up anything in advance, and so that you don't need to worry about some kids finding a thing, some kids not finding a thing, all the rest of it. Here's what you do. You give every parent in advance three little treasures. We had like glow sticks, a party hat, and then a little sweetie thing / non-food item for the people who prevent, the monsters who prevent their children from having sugar. You give each parent three surreptitiously to put in their pocket. You go to location one on a nice walk around the woods. You go, here we are, guys, I think there's some treasure here. All the kids run around looking for treasure. And when each parent reckons their kid has had enough looking, you just surreptitiously chuck a treasure on the floor and go, oh, what about down there? And then your daft toddler, who doesn't realise how life works, goes, wow. And they find a thing. So that's it. That's all the prep for your treasure hunt. So we did all of that, and it ended up in a little barn in a forest that I'd snuck into beforehand and set up some arguably pathetic fairy lights, arguably pathetic in daylight, and a mirror ball and a little speaker, which we then plugged into and played the old standards, Shake It Off by Taylor Swift and Inspector Norse by Todd Terje. So those are my son's favourite two songs at the minute. So he went absolutely nuts, bounced up and down and ran around shouting things like, this is the best thing ever. And my parenting heart, my little dad heart, absolutely soared. We had a huge, huge day out. Loads of friends having a great fun time in that way where it's like, it's a party that it's kind of rests on imagination. Like, the morning was such a nut. I'm congratulating myself because setting it up in the morning, I was like, oh shit, is this going to be crap? Is this actually a terrible idea? Is everyone going to go, all right, this is it, is it? And it worked. So probably a lot of the joy was actually relief. But just to tootle my own and my wife's trumpet, because she did most of the heavy lifting planning wise. And then Glory Hound Goldsmith turns up at the end and gets all the credit for lumping a tub around a forest. It was just so great. It was so great, guys. It was a really beautiful thing. And he was so, so happy. And then we came home and had wheeze. He ate entire chocolate ice cream for the first time in his life and then went mad. What a lovely day it's been. And the point I was making, was I making a point? Oh, that's it. The point I was trying to make was about how, like, you've got choices when you organise a thing, and let's say a children's birthday party or your own life. And the choice is, you can kind of decide to be safe and let someone or something take care of it all, or you can decide to try and go for sort of joy and imagination and, you know, the whole Muppet Babies thing, that lot. And you can, and it's a bigger risk, isn't it? And it struck me there's something in common. Oh, I'm such a hipster twat. There's something in common with shows and comedy and stuff. It's about trying, right? And sometimes when you try, it flops. And sometimes when you try, there's a danger of it flopping. And then it suddenly all comes together and you go, yes, I'm so glad that we did it like this, because it was really special and really memorable. But having said that, I can't remember my third birthday, or indeed anything really, before the age of about 11. So it's memorable to us, and he'll never remember it. And we didn't really take any photos. But it exists as smoke, much like fucking comedy. Oh, it was so great, man. It was so great. Anyway, that, okay, unashamed parenting one. Next week, gritty post-amble, I'm sure. Got some great stuff coming up. Had a brilliant conversation with Eggsy from Goldie Looking Chain. Eggsy from Goldie Looking Chain. Oh, my God. It was brilliant. And a really refreshing change as well from all the stand-up. And I've got another curveball to throw at you pretty soon. And I'm working on another really sexy curveball. So it's sexy in the sense of, exciting. As opposed to actually sexy. Which isn't just, oh, for fuck's sake, Goldsmith. I'm hopped up on birthday cake and I need a sleep. All right? I admire and respect you. Goodbye for now.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.